So what's Jared's last name?
Ramsey.
Hey, Ramsey.
Oh, you wrote it down. Cool.
Where are you sitting?
There's
lots of spots.
Is the choice too difficult? Are there too many chairs?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm lonely.
Okay. Well, we are covering pages 22 through 26. We're going to be looking at the issues of ventilation, lighting, the amount of mass that would be accumulated in the ark, and then some of the construction of the ark itself. So last week we talked about the waste needs. That kind of impacted a lot of people. Began to realize that actually it seems a whole lot more like a big litter box than a nice cruise ship. Good thing it was a one-time use thing. I'm pretty sure it'd be gross by the end of that year. Dealing with all that waste in that year. The visitor who is here, I was talking in the back, Miller, he talked about, there's a brother, he's a doctor and an archaeologist, Don Patton, I believe. I think he's in Hot Springs. He told me he's in Hot Springs, Arkansas right now. He said Don Patton has said that he has seen the ark in the mountains of Ararat. It's completely encased in ice. The mountains are all covered with ice right now. And actually, but the government of the area is not, they're Muslim. They don't really like, much like the Jews actually don't really like a lot of the Christian artifacts that come out of, or Bible artifacts that come out of Israel. The Israeli Antiquities Department, which is a government arm of Israel, actually controls all archaeological digs and finds in Israel. And they, things that tend to support, especially things that support Christianity, they really don't, they like to kind of keep a lid on and control. That's why it took them decades to release the Dead Sea Scrolls books. Some of them, he said actually about Dr. Patton, I think he is a preacher, I've heard of him before, I've never met him, but he actually, he preached, so he's, I think he's a preacher, probably in Hot Springs, Arkansas now, and he said he has also been on an archaeological dig that had seen rocks with a human footprint inside of a dinosaur footprint in rock. Now, in order for, because we have all kinds of dinosaur footprints in rock, right? Well, obviously it wasn't rock then. It was mud of some sort, but a footprint in it, and then it solidified and became rock over time. And there had, and I've heard of this and read about it, that people seeing these, it's rare. I think there's only been a couple or so that have been witnessed and people have testified to. Now, he was telling me that another archaeologist at the University of Houston actually broke up that ground that he had seen this in. But it's just testimony that's out there. Kind of interesting. But I've heard of it before. And the only way for a dinosaur's and a human footprint to be in the middle of a dinosaur would have both, they both would have stepped on the same mud before it solidified. And that's why archaeologists who don't believe in God would be very upset by that finding, because supposedly the difference between dinosaurs and the first humanoids is millions of years. So they're separate. They don't believe we've ever existed on the planet together. And it would, something like that discovered and proven would throw a massive amount of science out. And we'd, like, okay, we'd have to rework everything that we think. And I don't know, part of me thinks that something like that may happen. I don't know, something that exact thing, but something like that may happen in the next, you know, in the future. Much like the Dead Sea Scrolls really ended up answering the skeptics saying this is just kind of all made up because we can't really find most of these places and these people. Or it is kind of, we don't have any real historical evidence of any of this stuff. And then, you know, the Dead Sea Scrolls and, oh, wow, these scriptures, old scriptures go way, way back. And they've been the same for, you know, 2,000 years plus. And I think we tend to discover that the Bible is right. You know, I mean, I don't know about you. Even as, like, a parent, sometimes you're, like, trying to find the right thing to do to kind of get through your kids. And you kind of, you know, you try this, that, and the other thing, and you kind of get advice and you do stuff. And then you kind of, in the end, end up going, you get, often you come back to, you know, what God has said, and go, oh, it makes so much sense. I just understood what he said there the first time. Okay, well, let me get things set up and start it up. Is that Sean on there? Okay. I don't want to be a butterfly. I'm a butterfly. I have already been in that transformation process. Gone through a metamorphosis. Okay. So, the, on this, so the ventilation, because the biggest one of the biggest problems of the ark is actually all of the animals, the heat produced by all the animals. Now, I don't know if you've heard, when our air conditioning goes on in the front, you really hear it, right? And there's a reason, or just when the heat or air conditioning goes on, and there's a reason for that. When the engineer who engineered the heating system for this building. Okay, we're going to have maybe 120 or so at maximum in this room. He went, you know, okay. And that room and those front rooms are all on its own system. This back half of the building from the foyer this way has a different system. Okay, and these two actually have their own. But what happened is he went, okay, we could put one furnace in here for heating. One furnace would be totally fine for heating. Because you already have the heat of all the bodies. You have all these 98, you know, 0.6 degree bodies in there. And we all give off heat. And so that's why the room becomes warmer as we sit there longer. And he says, it'd be really tough to possibly cool it. If it was full, one air conditioning unit might not cool it. We'd probably need two. So we would only have, so in that front corner room, there are two furnaces that sit right together. They actually are twinned together. They're connected, so they run like one. But it's actually running into the system together. They draw together and then they push out together. But the purpose for that is cooling. We got, how do you cool it? That many bodies in. And that's actually one of the bigger problems of the ark. How are you going to cool it? And there's two things that really that are involved in that. One is the water itself. Being a box sitting in water would be dissipating heat. The second thing, though, that's really, really critical is actually that little window that it says at the top of the third level. You've got to have under, you know, probably an eave, but there needs to be like an 18-inch opening all the way down the sides. And so that he's kind of done the math on, is that enough ventilation to dissipate the heat that would be, you know, growing from all of these lives inside that box? So primarily for dissipation of heat, is the one window top enough? Under eave slots widely used in rabbitries and intensive swine buildings. So when you have big, large facilities that deal with, like, say, pigs, and even rabbits, this a window under the eave is a common ventilation. And one of the reasons we do that at the top is to kind of create circular patterns of airflow. And so what is happening in the Ark, actually, what's described in the Ark, is done in modern housing for lots and lots of animals. So some smoke release studies that were done, you know, going back a couple of decades ago, demonstrate that air in animal houses is in constant circulation due to interaction of animal body heat with cooler wall surfaces. It's actually the reason for wind. I don't know anybody ever really kind of heard the explanation of why does wind happen? And when you hear that weathermen talk about high pressure and low pressure and it's, you know, hot and it's colder, well, hot and cold is what causes air to flow between them. And it's those differences that causes things to circulate. And so in, you know, an animal house that has a lot of animals in it, there is a natural air kind of circulating because of warmth and cooling. And in this case, with the Ark, you'd have that water up against the outside walls, which would act like a heat sink. Everybody know what a heat sink is? If you ever open a computer, like this one probably has it on the CPU, the central processing unit, the little chip, usually about this big, you know, only about an eighth of an inch thick, usually, all kinds of prongs, it sits in the motherboard of a computer. All computer systems are essentially the same. The CPU, the central processing unit, is always running, and it gets really hot. And so you cool it, and then you put fans. Like this one has a built-in little fan here. If you put your hand here, you can feel hot air being blown out the side. And all of our home computers, you can hear a little fan going, right? It's drawing air from outside the room that's maybe 70 degrees or so, which is cool. Even though it might feel warm, even if it's like 75 and it feels warm to us, for a CPU, this might be getting up to 100 to 200 degrees. It's cool. So if you're drawing that 70 degree air across the CPU and getting rid of that air next to it that has gotten hot. Well, a heat sink on a CPU, especially bigger CPUs, this one probably doesn't have it because it's so thin. Most laptops don't. A heat sink is actually like a piece of aluminum where they actually glue it. And it looks like it's kind of flat. And they usually make them, so here's the CPU, say, with all the little prongs, you know, going into the motherboard. And it's just kind of glued right on top, a heat sink. And it's usually like aluminum. And it kind of looks like this. Okay, actually, I shouldn't put lines up there. Because it's actually all these little ridge things. And the reason for all these ridges is surface. We want a ton of surface area because metal is going to absorb the heat. And then it will cool it down. The metal that's glued on top of that CPU is pulling heat from the CPU, and then you blow air across it and get rid of the heat.
Isn't it kind of like a radiator?
Yes, similar concept, yes. And the in the heat sink, so the walls of the Ark would have acted like a heat sink. Since they have something cool outside of them, water, they would have the heat being generated, the walls would have been sucking it in, okay, and acting essentially like that heat sink. And radiator is kind of a similar thing. They're taking and passing through all of these flanged, you know, a radiator. They're taking fluid that's running through your coolant fluid that's running through your engine. They've been run through an outside thing right in front. So as you drive, the air comes across all those little fins to cool the coolant, to cool it down before it goes back into the engine and recirculates back out. So the coolant comes in, it's cooled, circulates into the engine to moderate temperature. And everybody who's had, you know, coolant leak understands and realizes, you know, what happens to their car when they don't have coolant in it, and all of a sudden the engine's, you know, temperature gauge, things start to smoke.
It's happening.
Anyway, so the difference between them would have served a purpose to actually cause some ventilation. Now, the recommended design ratio of inlet size per unit length for sheep housing yields a 14-inch high window for an arc-sized animal house. So the design for a animal building, what present concept recommends, like a 14-inch window up in the top, all down the wall, for the amount of space in the arc. Well, how big is that opening? 18 inches roughly, right? 18 to 21, somewhere in that kind of range, which is what a cubit would have run. So it actually is. I mean, that's, he told, and remember, think about it. God's the one that told him, you need to put a window of this size at the top of these walls.
Where is that?
Is that Genesis? Is that 6? 6 or 7?
Well, 6 is...
I'm trying to remember. Probably 7. Probably chapter 7.
I thought so. I was trying to find what it said about the window.
Yeah, let's go read that one real quick. Six is where we first come in contact with... anybody who sees it first?
It's 6:16, but in the ESV it reads different. It says make a roof for the ark and finish it to a cubit above, but if you look at the footnote for roof, it says skylight.
Yeah. So 6:16.
6:16, it says, in the New King James, it says, you shall make a window.
Well, he says, make a roof for the ark and finish it to a cubit above the what?
The wall.
Yeah. So I'm making a roof and I'm finishing it. I'm putting the roof a cubit above the wall. That means there'll be some kind of posts to go from the roof to the top of the wall. Why am I doing? So I've left an 18-inch opening at the top of the wall. Okay?
Because I always, you always picture open toe. And when somebody lets the bird out, it sends an open window. So, it's a good picture of the window, which of course would not be adequate. But
See, how does it read exactly on the laying the bird out? He sent forth again. He opened the window of the ark that he had made.
Yeah. So it might have been.
So in 8:6, so it seems as if they had some way of closing it. So he's got something that he can open to let them out.
Well, it did say something about a covering over the ark.
Well, yeah, and he's got to make a roof or something.
So what's your science 16?
Is it 8:6?
Oh,
where is
6:16?
You shall make a window for the ark, and you shall finish it to a cubit from above.
Yeah. Okay.
Which is not vague.
From above. New King James.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so
CSV doesn't say window at all. Just says.
The New King James says the same.
What was that?
The New King James says the same thing about the window.
Yeah. And even the ESV is saying the word might be skylight. So anyway, there's some kind of 18-inch, finish it to 18 inches, so an 18-inch, I think what's generally thought of is the roof is being put on top of the walls and finished 18 inches from the wall, so that you've got, in fact, you know when you go to some of the little buildings that are in the parks, and what, they have walls there. What do they do at the tops of the walls? They're always open. And the reason they're always open is for ventilation to flow inside those little structures. And that's why every building, like even this building, has ventilation above this wall. In that attic, there's ventilation above there. The eaves have, some mesh that allows air to flow up, and then we have at the top there are places for air to flow out, and it's designed for airflow and ventilation. So that is something we know, because what happens without it is things get kind of musty and stale and you know, rot. That's why we put fans in bathrooms. Is to get that moisture out of the air so it doesn't sit and cause mold and mildew to grow. Now, modern effects of water on temperature. Water just automatically keeps things cooler. Anybody who's lived near an ocean knows that the temperature just doesn't vary that much near the ocean because of that, the temperature of the ocean right there. I mean, yeah, we go the ocean like on the Pacific where we lived, you know, either in the Bay Area or when I lived down near Santa Barbara. The ocean, the closer you are to the ocean, the more it stays the temperature. Like in where I live near Pismo Beach, we generally are between 60 and 80 degrees all year round. Rarely be below 60, rarely above 80. It happened occasionally, but not often. But 10 miles inland from us, like everybody's ever been to Solvang, a little town. Solvang is roasting hot. we lived about 10 miles from Solvang. So we lived right near there. Just inland that little bit, we would roast there. We'd be like 80.
Of course, it was in the hills, too.
Because it is. There's a little hills, because the ocean, and you got little hills, and it's kind of on the other side of a little mountain range. And it'd be like 95. I mean, it was 80 here for us. And we're like, oh, that's right. It was hot for us, because at 80, down by the beach, nobody had AC, air conditioning near there. And we had little dinky furnaces. We used no AC or anything, and didn't have to turn the AC on, or the heater on all that often. Just a few miles inland, and just massively different. So close to the ocean, and that, it's all because of the ocean temperature. Because the ocean, no matter what time of the year, it's staying somewhere between, 50, mid-50s to mid-60s. The Pacific's always cold. But anyway, so that would have had a huge effect on keeping temperature controlled, basically being buried in all that water. Now, I think the difficulty would have been when they actually sat on ground for the last half of that year. Now we know those mountains now are covered in ice, but at that time they obviously weren't yet. But it might have been cool up there. I mean, it might have begun to cool. As the water began to recede, we might have started to get mountains and moving up. And, because the waters may not have been going down, too. It's possible the mountains were also coming up to meet Noah. Especially some of the Psalms describe this. But the idea that we don't really know. Somehow, where he ends up landing, that region, the mountains all are snow-capped now, year-round. And so people who try to go there, and the guy who has said he has seen it, it's encased in ice. And it actually wouldn't completely surprise me that it does exist if it actually got encased in ice. One of the things ice would do is prevent the wood from rotting. I mean, I don't know if it's still there. I mean, I never was sure about that. Somebody, some brother says he's seen it. I don't have any reason to question him. He says because I do know that some of those governments that control the area are not friendly to archaeologists who are Christians. I do know that to be true, but. Anyway, the lighting. So ventilation, we got to keep everything cool, air flowing. Lighting. That's again another thing. Today, when you build a house, or even a commercial building like this church building, when you go to put in plans, you have to have so much light. And we're not talking about these kinds of lighting. There has to be so much light from windows to the amount. So the amount of area in windows is determined by your floor area. You can sometimes go bigger and more windows, but you have to have a minimum. He might be having trouble. And the issue when you get more windows in a house, actually you're having to deal with a different issue. You can put more than your minimum, but when you put more, then you actually have to do something to actually keep the warmth in. You have to do some more things to the construction to try and maintain, keep that. Because the one problem with a window, in terms of temperature, windows are considered a hole. Okay? There's like, for the way they actually do in buildings, the way engineers consider, the windows are just holes in the wall. We put windows in, it stops the air flowing across, but it doesn't really stop cool and heat from coming in and out. We have double pane windows, which slows it a little bit. That doesn't slow it all that much. Triple pane windows slows it even more, but they're really crazy expensive too. So we need light, we need a certain ratio, and the ratio of window to floor area for the arc is 4.6%. So in the total square footage, if we assume under at the top of the wall, top of this box, is an 18-inch opening, then we have 4.6% to the floor area. And the design ratio for naturally lit stanchion barns for cows. So that's basically you got tons of cows, right? So I got to put up a roof. I got to put some walls up to it. And typically barns, you know, they have eaves open. They're not, you know, we're not building them like houses. Critters can run through and things can run through, but you kind of put some walls up and keep things air flowing. But you need, if you're just going to have no light in there, they say you need about 6.5% or almost 7% of the amount of floor area in the opening for light to come in. Design ratio for an intensive confinement of sheep is 3-5%. So big buildings that they build for putting a lot of sheep in, is they use 3-5%. Some of the areas on the lower deck will probably be dark. I think we've already talked about that to some degree. It appears the way it is described in Scripture that the window, per se, is only at the top. So it's only on the third floor, which would make the first level probably really dark. And the second level would probably be not quite as dark, where you could kind of, your eyes could get adjusted and you could see a little bit. First level almost might be so dark, if you didn't have a light, it might almost be, you can't get used to it. But they could have used candles or lamps, right? We know the ancient world did those things. They had wicks.
Oil lamps.
They had oil lamps. They also, there's other sources that are used in the world as well. Also fireflies are used, and luminous bacteria. In fact, one of the stories that he writes about is that in Japan, in the World War II, because of we were bombing Japan at times, that they had to have lights out. Well, what they did at night to learn to read was they used luminous bacteria. They were growing it and using it to glow so they could read by at night. And there are places in the world that have used fireflies as well. I think in China, he talked about some of the poor places. In China is incredibly poor. There are places in China that have wealth. The big cities they've been building for the last couple of decades are incredibly new, modern. But the majority of China is still third world living. They're in outhouses. They're not in houses like we would expect. or even the people of the cities of China. China, much of their population is still at just, I don't know, it's been a while since I read about it, but a huge percent. It's probably not 50%, but it's probably like 25, it's like a quarter or a third of their population is still basically living with almost nothing. And in some of those places, they have used fireflies. They have captured fireflies.
Don't they even still have a band where they can only have one child?
They recently, I believe, changed it. They had that band for a long time. Then it actually got modified, maybe within the last decade or two, to modify where you could pay to have a second child. So obviously only rich people could do it, because it'd be like $10,000 to pay to have a second child. But I have read some things recently that they may have done. I don't know if anybody else has read it. I think recently they may have kind of moved away from that a little bit, the absolute ban on the same.
Because like if somebody had another child, they'd have to kill it. Isn't that what they did, or put it up for adoption or something?
Well, they often... some of that, yeah, probably both of those things. They did kill them. It's one of the reasons that in China today, one of the reasons they have to do something different is that they have a massive number of Chinese males that are never going to marry and have children. And it's because there's not enough females in their society. Because the people... most of the people were still living in situations where they were expecting their eldest son to take care of them when they're older. And most of them still are in the situation where they need that. They don't have Social Security and stuff like that. I mean, a lot of people there still need that. And they have, so they were killing girls at great rates, and they were aborting them when they really found out they were girls, so to have sons. Well, they've got millions of men that will never marry, at least in China, if they stay there. So, just not enough. The odds are, it's better for girls, but it's actually quite an interesting. It's quite an interesting study about looking at their society, what's going to happen to their society, because it's been actually noted by other social scientists that have looked at this. One of the things a society has to do is figure out what to do with young males. Because who commits most violent crime in America today?
Young males.
Males between the age of 16 and 25.
Yeah.
If you give them no work, and if they are not working or not productive in some way, you're going to have a problem. It's a little bit like...
Especially when they also can't get a woman.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
They can't. If they don't get married and they don't have work, you've got gangs. And really, you see this in animal kingdom. What happens to male lions when they grow up? You know?
They have to go away.
They're kicked out. There's only one male to a pride of lions.
Sometimes two, very rare.
Yeah. They're accepting somebody. But what happens in a pride, so you have a bunch of females and you have the one male. And he, as soon as a male is born, when they're cubs, they're going to be fine. They're going to stay in the middle, they're taking care of. But once he's old enough, and he may take over from the one who's the head of the pride, he may kill that one or make that one leave. But typically, when they become like a teenager level, so they are actually got, they're moved out of the tribe. But one of the problems, the most dangerous lions is actually these little groups of males that have been kicked out of tribes.
Little gangs.
They are. They form these little groups of the kind of stragglers that have been kicked out. And they are they're terribly vicious, and they'll kill prides, they'll kill livestock, they are Because the prides are actually controlled by the female, the lead female. Even though the male essentially has a certain level of control, he doesn't do any of the hunting.
Yeah.
The females do all the hunting, and the lead female of the pride actually runs the pride. But those females need protection from the males. Because the males are actually built, male lions, which are very different from like a male tiger. Because a male lion is not really built for hunting. You look at a male lion, we see they have their big head. They're built for fighting. And their heads are
huge.
Yeah. They're actually shorter than the females, generally. And they look bigger than they actually are. Their bodies are smaller, typically. But their jaws are immense compared to the female. If you ever see a skull of a male, the skull of a female lions are really quite different. Incredible that they are like that. But anyway, social scientists have recognized this for a while. Every place in human kind of history where males have become kind of outcasts, or there's become a large male population that does not get married and work, you have a lot of social problems. It's a very dangerous society to live in. And so, what's going to happen in China? What will happen because of that? It's an interesting sociology kind of
bunch of marks kill each other.
And China's gangs,
that population problem.
And Chinese gangs have been on the rise now for quite a few decades, especially the Chinese gangs in Southern California and the Bay Area. I mean, the Chinese gangs don't exist in most places other than areas where there are large Asian populations. But some of the Asian gangs are just...
Well, their leader is kind of crass on his own.
Who's that?
Isn't their leader... He's got the bowl around his head haircut.
Oh, you're talking about the South Korean...
Is it South Korea?
You're talking about the North Korean dictator?
Oh, somebody.
I'm not sure.
I thought it was
the leader of the country. Well, the Koreans are
about the same good.
They're similar. I mean, Koreans and both Asians, but I don't know if you're talking about Kim Jong.
Yeah,
that's him.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, he's not really the leader of these
gangs.
The leader of these gangs they are connected back to mainland China and even Taiwan, even some Hong Kong. Some of the Chinese Asian gangs that roam. Anybody see the movie Gran Torino? Kind of a
years ago.
Difficult movie, but actually talks about the Muns and the gangs that they were having. The movie's about essentially this old man. Clint Eastwood becomes an old man in his neighborhood that becomes a lower priced neighborhood, and what moves in around him as he gets older is, all of these, the Muns are, I can't remember exactly where they're from, but...
Laos,
okay. And so there are all these refugees, and so there's these, and he's basically dealing with gangs, and the neighbor boy, he ends up befriending this neighbor family, protecting them a little bit, even though he's kind of the grumpy old man, get off my lawn. He basically lives in an area of gangs. And that's what you live in a lot of places like that in California. Were nice little communities at one time, and now they are areas that most people don't want to travel in if you can live someplace with more, afford something nicer. Anyway, I don't know how we got there from lighting, but...
Sorry. Yeah, it went from fireflies and luminous bacteria.
Yeah, in China, in the poor areas of China, they still do fireflies in bags and use them. Yeah, is it much like we see in stories where they put fireflies in little jars and use them for lighting? People have been pretty ingenious, what's the old saying? Necessity is the mother of invention. We figure out ways to do things. The advantage of darkness, though, I know we've talked a little bit about this already. livestock and animals in that lower level would be very, very quiet and calm, generally. When you put animals in darkness, they generally lay down and don't move around a lot. They also typically, and many of them actually semi-hibernate. Some actually do hibernate, which would be really a huge advantage, wouldn't it, for all the animals that do that. But for all animals, even the ones that don't hibernate, if they could essentially sleep for much of that time, that would have been a huge advantage. So the darkness of the lower levels, I would think, would be something they could really use in trying to can maintain a lot of animals in that space. Burrowing animals adapt well to captivity when caged in darkness. So you go to the zoo. Well, what's one of the problems of going to a zoo of animals that like to burrow?
You don't see them.
The meerkats. That's why you have to build a little wall with them to get out there in the sun and stand up on the rock. or you try to build something into their little burrows that we can see into them a little bit. Because they don't want to be around people. They don't want to burrow and go into the dark. So burrowing animals, you would have put most of those in that lowest space. Animals that would burrow. Nocturnal animals can be housed in poorly lit areas, right? You look at lots and lots of birds, a lot of felines. A lot of cats do hunt at night. They rest and lay around during the day and hunt at night. I don't know, does anybody have their cats bring them mice in the morning?
No,
we
did as a kid.
Nice.
That's why I'm terrified of mice. That cat really loved you. It did it, brought me a present.
Yeah, that's right. Special for you, too. You can eat it.
Yeah. Here. Breakfast is served.
Breakfast is
dead. We get quite a few body parts on the front porch.
Yes.
Those gifts.
He usually eats part of it.
I had a cat who used to rescue them. Go catch them and bring them to me, and then they'd run around the house.
Yeah, most cats don't want to kill them because they cease to be fun as soon as they die.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, those are the well-fed.
My dad told me to grab a hammer and hit it on the head. I'm like, I am not. He wasn't too bright, obviously.
No, anyway. Years ago, actually, when we first moved here, we had a cat and a dog. They were older, Roxy and Sydney. The two of them were roughly the same age. Julie and I, when we got married, we had both had them since they were just a few months old. And we had gotten them roughly at the same time. But they kind of became pretty good friends. But the first house that Julie and I lived in, we had to do some repairs to the house. So I put a lot of the construction debris, redoing some bathrooms to get ready to sell it. And so I put a lot of it into the side yard, went to go, a month or so goes by, when I was done, I went to go haul it off to the dump. And at the very bottom, I took a board, right at the very bottom, a little house, my mother and a bunch of little ones. So I poked a board up and out, and I ran. And we went and got, I hate mice, kind of the same reason you do. I had them in my house too, and in my room, found them in my clothes. Died and everything in there.
Oh,
anyway, so our dog, Roxy, was kind of a cross between a dachshund and a terrier. And so she was a great mouser. She liked to kill them. She would grab them and chomp them. She killed about 6 of the 9 within less than 8 seconds, probably.
Oh, my.
When I dropped the board, they all ran back under to the place. So we went and got the animals, brought the dog out, and Julie actually went and lifted the board again because I'm freaked out by mice. And so she went and lifted the board, and they started to run, and Roxy just chomp, 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 killed a bunch of them. A few of them got away, and the cat actually tracked down a couple of them. And we just stand there. It was funny watching the cat. Cat knew one was under something. The cat stood there completely still for, I don't know, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, until it peaks out half. For whatever reason, I guess the mice need to move. And so even though the cat was there in plain sight, it decided to run across in front of her. And she got a, you know, right in the side, grabbed with the claws. Trying to get away. Play with it. And then Roxy go, hey, play with that. Let me go kill that. So Roxy run over and kill it. And then she go find another one. So she actually found three that Roxy killed. The two of them together are great. But she was so upset. The cat was so upset every time the dog killed it.
Rope on toll.
Well, the fun was over. It's like, I mean, just to watch the cat, though, play with, it's like, wow, that's kind of vicious. Those things
they
are.
They like throw it up in the air. That's
what
my cat
does. Oh, yeah.
Well, he would toss it. I remember Sydney would toss it, the claws, just right in its side, just flick it, and flick it, and grab it, and flick it. Just, yeah, just bat it. Yeah, I love to bat it.
It's
fun
to watch.
A mouse dig a hole through the wall. Just watched it.
Oh, yeah? Never did anything to it?
No, we finally brought in the dog.
Yeah. Actually, for killing them, dogs, terriers are way better at killing vermin than cats are. Cats will catch them and even eat them, but they'll leave a lot of them go.
No,
if they're full.
They'll eat the heads mainly.
Yeah, they're kind of, if they're full, they don't really bother them. You know, the dogs, though, you're in my territory and I'm going to kill you.
Can't be a part
of that. Anyway, was the ARC overloaded? I may go ahead and leave this. What time is it?
It's 12:08.
Okay. We're late. So I'll leave this. We'll pick it up here at slide 24.